This episode of The Ready Room is brought to you by Squarespace, the all-in-one platform that makes it fast and easy to create a professional website, blog, portfolio, and even an online store with the Squarespace Commerce feature. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase on new accounts, go to squarespace.com and use offer code TREK6. And also by TrekFan. TrekFan isn't just a Star Trek fan club, it's a challenge. You'll explore new places, learn new things, and collaborate with other fans to solve puzzles, complete real-life mission objectives, and win great prizes. To face your first challenge and find out more, head on over to TrekFan.org.
This is J.G. Hertzler, General Martok on Deep Space Nine, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Welcome to The Ready Room, show number 101, Kiss the Girl, Get the Key. I'm Christopher Jones, and with me today is Charlene Schmidt. We'll be talking about some Star Trek news, including a special edition DVD release of Trek Nation, new collectibles from Diamond Select, Alice Eve signing on for Star Trek Las Vegas, and we remember TOS's Catherine Woodville. Then in the feature, we're joined by Michael Fisher and Larry Nemechek to discuss the DS9 episode, Our Man Bashir. So let's step into the Ready Room. Hello, Char. How are you doing this week? Finally, we're back. After our big 100th celebration.
Whew. Tell you what, that was a biggie, wasn't it?
It was, and apparently, as we were discussing last night on iMessage, joining us for the next 100 shows over in the corner is Max Weinberg and the Max Weinberg 7!
It's Conan O'Brien doing his eyebrow maneuver.
What is Max Weinberg doing? I thought we were getting Max Krodenchik.
Sorry, I couldn't get him in time. He's busy doing something else. He was booked. So I got us Max Weinberg in the Max Weinberg 7. I mean, Max,
all right.
Max,
well,
close enough.
It's close enough. And as long as Vic Fontaine comes out and sings from time to time, I think I'll be happy.
I think that's doable. I think we could get Vic. And Max and the guys can certainly conjure up some kind of a swingy jazz tune. No problem. We got it.
I guess. So, listeners are wondering, what are they talking about?
Yes,
somehow, last night, Char, the other side of the room.
The other side of the room.
Started early this week, and it started last night on iMessage. We were talking about Star Trek, and somehow we ended up on Max Weinberg.
So. So we were talking all things Conan O'Brien and the Max on Max skit, if anybody remembers that.
Oh, gosh.
Yes, yes. We'll let you look that
Let's
up on YouTube.
About. Any of that right now. But thank you for everyone who did listen to our 100th Ready Room the week before last. We did take a week off last week because after such a big show, it was a double length show. That thing ran almost 3 hours.
Right.
We needed a little break and give everyone, you know, time to listen to it because obviously that was not a show to listen to in one session. But hopefully this one will be.
Right. Well, and not only did we have almost, 3 hours of material to go through, but you had to edit how many tracks for that thing? Oh man.
Yeah,
I can't imagine.
I had 10 separate voice tracks in audition for that show.
Yikes.
In addition to the sound effects and music.
Oh man.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was a monster. Luckily, I have a powerful machine. But anyway, let's jump into show number 101. And we have a fun one in store for everyone this week as Larry Nemechek will be joining us along with Michael Fisher to talk about Our Man Bashir. And Larry was on the set for most of the shooting of that episode. So there should be some really interesting things to talk about there. But before we get to that, Char, we haven't had to do this in a while, thankfully. But it's that time once again where we have to say goodbye to a member of the Star Trek family, as Catherine Woodville, who fans know from her role of Netira on the original series, died recently at the age of 74.
Right. She passed away on June 5th, but news of it just came out last week, toward the end of last week. And she had a very long struggle with cancer. And so, you know, it's one of those things where I'm sure it's very sad, but at the same time, she's no longer suffering. And that part of it is good.
Yeah, that is good. It's, you know, it's a young age to pass away, but
it is.
Yeah.
Yeah.
She had a long struggle, so at least that's over. And, you know, she played McCoy's love interest in For the World is Hollow and I Have Touched the Sky. And that's a memorable episode, not only because of the title, but, you know, it was a great Bones episode as well.
Right. And we didn't get enough of those. Bones is awesome.
Bones is awesome. Yeah. And Woodville was in this episode as well. So she will be missed. And we really appreciate her roles in Star Trek, as well as her other appearances, which those of us who have been watching television for many decades now will remember her from Mission Impossible, Little House on the Prairie, Wonder Woman.
Yeah.
And she was also in the first episode of The Avengers.
Yeah, those are some pretty impressive screen credits there.
She's also one of those Star Trek guests where it runs in the family. Her second husband, who passed away in 06, Edward Albert, played Zira in A Man Alone, the DS9 episode.
Yeah. I did not know that, actually, until I read her obituary and thought, wow, well, that's pretty interesting. That's neat.
Yeah, you never quite know, you know, some of these actors who are married to one another. So,
yeah.
Anyway, she will be missed.
Yes.
And hopefully we won't lose anyone else in the Trek family anytime soon, but...
Yeah, fingers crossed.
It, you know, the franchise is heading towards 50 years now, so...
Yes, it's a long time.
It's that time.
Yeah.
It is. So. Well, Char, speaking of the history of the franchise, last year we all enjoyed the documentary that Rod Roddenberry put together, Trek Nation, which was a very, very long time in the making. Mm-hmm. And all you guys in the States got to see it long before I did because I didn't have access to actually watch it. But finally, it was available on iTunes, so I downloaded it and I have seen it now. And the special edition DVD is going to be coming out in July with some additional material.
Oh, and you know me, I love extras. So bring it. I can't wait to see this stuff. We're going to get some director commentary. We're going to get some more interviews and some homemade movies from the Roddenberry estate. So I kind of wonder, I mean, is this Rod running around the yard when he's a little baby? Or what is this about exactly? I'm going to find out, especially for the price that Amazon has for pre-order right now. It's only $12.99. And the retail price is $24.98, so that's a huge discount.
Yeah, that is a great price. And the home videos, it could be Rod running around, quite possibly.
Who knows?
We'll find out.
I don't know. I'm very curious, and it sounds like fun.
The director commentary should be very interesting. I don't know if you watched them, but as Trek Nation was being released originally, Scott Colthorpe, who was the director of Trek Nation, did a series of short videos on YouTube where he would intro some portion of the documentary. They had some additional footage with people who appeared in the documentary, with fans as well as with actors.
There
was a lot of additional stuff put there, and I don't know if those will be on this DVD or not. It doesn't say, but they do talk about extended interviews and more, so it's possible. But I think Scott will have a lot of very interesting information to give us about how this documentary was put together. You know, there was a lot of traveling that went on all around the world, and it took quite a few years for a Trek Nation to be finalized from start to finish. So I'm a little bit disappointed personally that, as far as I can tell, there is no Blu-ray edition of this coming out. And the reason I say that is because it is... in HD. I bought it from iTunes in 1080p HD. And of course, you can't put that on a DVD. So the image quality is going to be downgraded from what I currently have.
Yeah.
So I'll probably buy it just for the director's commentary and for the extras. But it would be wonderful if they would also put out a Blu-ray version of this so that we can have the full HD video quality to go along with all the extras.
Yeah, now that you mention that, I don't understand why they don't have that in the works. I mean, that's just kind of the standard these days, isn't it?
It is. They might feel that there's not necessarily a market for a small documentary to put out two editions. That's possible, but
maybe so.
It would be nice since the actual show is in HD. But
yeah.
At any rate, if you're interested in this, we'll put a link in the Enhanced podcast and in the show notes, and you can hop over and pre-order for this fantastic low price of $12.99.
Yeah, pretty good deal, even though it's not in Blu-ray.
Even though.
Even though. But you know what I'm even more excited about, Chris? Are these toys that are available now for pre-order from Diamond Select. And, I mean, have you ever just wanted to have somebody really trustworthy save your money for you? And I'm not talking about just your bank. I'm talking about a Spock piggy bank.
A Spocky bank.
A Spocky bank.
Yes.
I like it. It's very cute. Yes, apparently this is going to be a reality very soon, and wow. You know, I had not thought about this before, thinking, you know, I really would rather that I put my coinage into Spock's head, or actually, I think you have it's the slot in the back. You put it in his back and think, well, that's the best place to put my money. Now that I know that this is going to be a real thing, I can't think of anything better.
I think every Star Trek fan would trust Spock with their money and also would love to have this 8-inch tall Spocky bank on their desk.
Yeah, why not?
I don't even want to ask how you get the coins out of Spock.
Well, the politically correct way it's phrased on Diamond Select's website is that there is an access door in the base. Take that.
That sounds like code language to me.
Yeah, take that for whatever you will. I'm not going to say a thing further before I get myself in trouble. I have to wait till, like, what is it, 58 minutes till I can do that in the show?
Right.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah.
And that's 58 minutes into the feature.
Right. Then you can explain exactly what an access port in the base really means.
And, you know, I'd feel kind of dirty doing that to Spock, but dang it, if I need my money. But anyway, if Spock is not the person you want to trust with your money, apparently Diamond Select Toys is going to release several of these, and they've not yet said who they're going to be releasing busts of, bust banks of, but I'm guessing it's going to be original series if they start with Spock, but not necessarily. I don't know. Could be anybody.
Well, I will tell you, the one that I would never buy, absolutely never buy, is if they do a Quark coin bank.
Oh, no, no.
I would not trust Quark with my money.
No, you put your money into his back and he's going to disappear with it. Especially
absolutely.
Right at that point where it starts to get full and he knows you're going to cash it out.
That's right.
And then all of a sudden you can't find it. Hmm. Well then, isn't that special?
Oh, so yeah, I'm sure there will probably be a Kirk and a McCoy anyway, and then
surely, yeah.
Everyone's on a big TOS kick these days. We were also talking about yesterday, Char, you and I, how in the novels for the first half of this year, it's just TOS, 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 TOS.
Oh my goodness! Yes, Matt Rushing keeps sending me reviews for the newest books, and it's just TOS book after TOS book, and I'm thinking, what about TNG and DS9? I'd like to read some of that, too. And I know that something for TNG is on the horizon. And then Voyager has a book being released in January of next year. But it's definitely been a little bit of overkill for TOS.
Yeah. Yeah, well, they do this with Into Darkness coming out. They've just gone all out with the TOS marketing.
Yeah.
And, of course, we love TOS and we love having the TOS
sure.
books. But for the overall fan base, it's nice to have a bit of variety all the time. And
yeah, yeah. Variety's good.
Now, yeah, there's TNG coming out. The Fall is coming out in the fall.
Ha-ha.
And those books have elements of DS9 and TNG. It's the mixed universe, you know, of all the series
right.
coming in. There's a new Enterprise book coming out as well. So we're going to be getting back into some variety here. But I don't expect to see any DS9 or Enterprise coin banks coming.
Maybe not. And that's too bad because I'd really like to have Porthos next to Spock.
Porthos would be a little cheese bank. You just put your cheese in his head.
That's not a good idea.
There's an access door in the base. And,
Okay, let's not go there. This is going to end badly, no matter what you do.
Okay, well, enough on the coin banks. It's not the only thing that Diamond Select has coming out. This other item that they have coming out is interesting to me. It's like a little silicon mold that you can use to make ice cubes, gelatin, candies, and whatnot.
Yeah, I think it's kind of nifty. If I really, I mean, besides making ice cubes for my vodka, if I did any of these things, like make candies and stuff, I'd be totally into this. Because you have a mold of the Enterprise D on this thing, and then the Starfleet insignia.
Yeah, now the question I have is, how can we expand this line? You know, what other shapes would you like to make ice cubes of, or gelatin, or vodka shots, or whatever?
Yeah, well, I'm thinking we need some Borg cubes, because that would be perfect little ice cubes. Well, I mean, that's a no-brainer right there.
Do they already have that at ThinkGeek? Do they? I know they have a Death Star.
Do they?
Ice cube tray. Do they have a Borg cube ice cube tray? Because if they don't,
they need to get on that.
That's a real fail. ThinkGeek, get on that.
Yeah, right, seriously. And being the Voyager fan that I am, I would love to see little Voyager ice cubes in my vodka. That would be cool. I could do that. But then, you know, I think this is not something we should just limit to Star Trek. I think this could be expanded to so many other series, and you know what I'm going to say now, right? We need bosom buddies!
Oh, man. Bosom buddy ice cubes. I can just see those floating in your drink.
Yeah, I would buy that in such a heartbeat. I can't even tell you. I wouldn't even think about it.
Oh, goodness. We can take it further. We could have Alf ice cubes.
Sure.
Look like little cats. I don't think your cat Teddy would appreciate that very much, though, Char.
He might kind of wonder what's going on with that, yes. Like, am I next? I mean, he did get his hair cut over the weekend, so, I mean, in his mind, anything is possible, probably. I mean, what's next? Are you going to chop me up? Oh, no. Poor thing. I wouldn't do that to him.
Poor thing, yeah.
Poor baby.
So I would love to hear from the listeners what type of shapes they would like to have and what they would make with them. Because, again, this is not limited only to ice. You can make all sorts of things out of this.
Yeah.
But these will be coming soon. They're available for pre-order starting June 21st, which is actually already passed. So you can use the links and you can hop over to Diamond Select and pre-order these things right now if you're so inclined. Now, Char, I've been asked many, many times recently if I'm going to be going to Star Trek Las Vegas. And I had really, really been planning to go this year, but things just aren't really quite working out. It's a really, really huge undertaking for me to go from Japan all the way to Las Vegas. So it's looking right now like I'm probably not going to be able to make it this year. However, there is someone who is going to make it that I think many fans will be very excited about.
And I know that as soon as Matt Rushing hears this, he's going to be ordering his tickets to go. Because Alice Eve is the newest guest to be added to the Star Trek Las Vegas lineup.
I think after Matt hears this, he's going to send a message and say, will you guys stop talking about me on the Ready Room?
Yes, in fact, that might be the first thing he does. Then he's going to get tickets to Star Trek Las Vegas.
Then he's going to go.
I'm sorry, Matt. You know we love you.
But this is good to hear, because actually Matt and I were talking on one of the shows recently about the fact that none of the Abramsverse actors have done a con up to this point. Mm-hmm. So Alice Eve will be the very first actor from either of the JJ films, except for Leonard Nimoy, of course, as Prime Spot, to actually do a convention.
Yeah, so this is going to be very exciting, and she's going to be on stage Sunday. And they have not said when, but she will also be available for autographs and photos. So it sounds like she's just going to jump right in and do the whole gamut of it. And no, for the record, there is no word yet on whether or not she's going to strip down to her undies. And I wouldn't count on it, because I'm sure there's going to be a whole line of guys asking her about that scene.
Oh, you know.
Asking her to show off her undies that she's wearing that day. And I honestly feel bad for her. Why did she sign up to do this?
I do too. Well, I don't think she signed up to do that in
no.
particular.
But I mean, she obviously knows where this is going to head really quickly. Don't you think?
Yeah. Oh, you're talking about signing up to do the convention.
The convention,
I was talking
not
about
to take
signing
off her
up
undies
to do the
per
movie.
Se, no.
No, I was talking about signing up to do the movie and having that scene in the movie.
Oh, no. No, I honestly don't think they think, or I don't think they thought it would be the big deal that it is. But when you put it into a promo like that, well.
That's the thing. Like, you know, for me, it's not a big deal. And I think that society in general is a little bit too uptight about these things, because it really shouldn't be such a big thing. But now, I haven't seen the movie yet. I am finally going to be going to Paramount tomorrow to see the movie.
Oh, thank goodness.
I finally will see it. We still actually have 2 months to go before the public release here in Japan, which is insane.
But Star Trek in August.
After I see the movie and I see how that scene fits into the film and I can put it into context, I'll finally be able to have a proper full opinion about it. But I feel, like you said, I feel bad for her too, that I'm sure that there's so much more to her role in the movie. And there's this one little bitty tiny scene where she's in her underwear, but they put it in the teaser trailer and therefore it became this huge thing.
Right. So, and then suddenly that's it.
It's too
that's
bad.
Everything.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And
it's been fun to joke about, you know, here and there, but it shouldn't be defining her role in the movie. But at any rate, back to the convention, my question now is, will this be the first step to them getting other people like Chris Pine and Zachary Quinto and Zoe Saldana to come to Star Trek Las Vegas? And is there still enough time for them to possibly secure some of those actors for this year's con?
That's a really good question. And I'm sure it boils down to the actors' availability, because a lot of them are working on movies and have extraordinarily busy schedules. So if they're shooting something right now, obviously that's out. But it would be great to see more of them there, definitely. And I know that, I mean, if they're adding Alice Eve as of this weekend when we're recording this, hey, there's still room for more. I think they're going to keep working on it.
That's something we're not used to as Star Trek fans, I think. The fact that the actors in current Star Trek aren't available to do Star Trek themes, really, because they are all in the middle of their careers at different stages, but they all have other movies going on or other TV projects or stuff going on all the time. And Star Trek is just something that they do for a short period of time right now, every 4 years.
Right.
We're so accustomed to when Voyager was on television or Enterprise was on or DS9 was on or TNG was on, that was the full-time job for those actors. And so they could come do these conventions. So it's a different situation.
It is. I don't know if we're going to see more appearances. Like, is this going to be the icebreaker, or are they just, is this something that's just not really a priority for them and this is going to be a really rare thing?
Yeah, I kind of lean towards that. And then 20 years from now, if anyone remembers the Abrams verse Star Trek anyway,
that might be it.
They will then be coming to conventions, right? Because once you're in Star Trek, it's a lifetime thing for you. So
it really is. I don't know. In all honesty, I always thought the first person who would appear at a convention would be Zachary Quinto.
Right? Yeah.
Because
he's
also
into it. Very, very busy.
And
he is into it, I think.
Yeah. And especially if Leonard Nimoy is there, because they're buds.
Yeah, I think he's totally into it. But like you said when we started this conversation, it's a time thing for these actors because they are all so busy these days. And so we'll see. But at least they're adding Alice. And that's nice. I know fans will love to see her there. And
absolutely.
Hopefully she'll be able to give a lot of behind the scenes about being on the set and shooting into darkness and stuff that we haven't heard before.
Yeah, it'll be nice to have some fresh stories, especially for those who have been able to go to these conventions for several years. And you mentioned that you're not going to be able to go. I am going to go, for sure. Everything is bought and paid for. I'm going, come hell or high water. It's going to happen somehow. And I cannot wait to see Alice Eve. I can't wait to see everybody, quite frankly. I can't wait to just jump into that mayhem and probably live off of nothing but adrenaline for 4 days and then come back very exhausted. But it's going to be such
You will come back exhausted.
Yes, yes.
You will come back exhausted for sure.
I've heard stories. But there's people who've been doing this for years and years, and so it will be very good to have a fresh face in the lineup.
Oh, most definitely. Well, that's all we have for news this week. But before we jump into the feature and our conversation with Michael and Larry, Shar, let's tell everyone a little bit about our sponsor, Squarespace. Now, Shar, every week we talk about the features of Squarespace, and we talk about how you build a page using blocks and, you know, how the layout engine works. And we talk about the responsive design and how it helps you to get your website looking great on both desktop and mobile devices without doing a lot of extra work. But this week, instead of talking about the features, let's tell listeners a little bit about how Squarespace is used in the real world. And Squarespace themselves, they just launched their first really big branding initiative, and it's called Create Your Own Space. And they put together a 1-minute video, which everyone should go watch because it's absolutely beautifully done. And it shows how people use the very flexible Squarespace platform in real life to meet the needs of the very different fields that people work in. Shar, you and I watched the video just before we went on the air, and what are some of the standouts from the video that got your attention, you know, that how people are using Squarespace?
What I liked from this video is that it shows that there is a way for anybody to use Squarespace, no matter what you do, no matter what you do for a living, what you're trying to do with your life or what have you. Say if you want to start your own business, you can do that on Squarespace. There's the store package that you can get to sell your products. That's awesome. If you're an artist, Squarespace is also for you because it can help you with a very clean design and showcase your work. And in this video, they show that basically anybody can use Squarespace and achieve their goals, whether it's to showcase an idea or a business, your work, a store, or even just a personal website where you want to blog your thoughts or show something off, your writings, who knows, you can do it. And it's going to be awesome. It's going to look great.
Right. In the video, because the campaign is Create Your Own Space, they have, as you just mentioned, create your own idea, create your own business, create your own image. You know, your image and projecting a professional image of yourself online is extremely important, whether you're a company or you're just an individual. You don't even have to be selling anything. You know, maybe just in social media, you know, you want to talk about, like we talk about Star Trek, and you want to have a great image.
Yeah.
Creating a professional image is important, and it can take a lot of work, but as they show in the video, Squarespace makes it very, very simple and easy for you to create that image for yourself. They also talk about create your own canvas. You know, if you're an artist, there's no better platform for showing off your work and promoting your work through social media than Squarespace. Create your own anthem. If you're a musician, it's a great way to present your compositions online. There's a audio block in Squarespace, which is really fantastic. You can just drag it onto your page, and then you can drag your audio file into that block, and Squarespace will host the file for you, of course, but also give you this very beautifully designed, streamlined player on your page where people can just click and play. So you don't have to mess with hosting your audio file somewhere else, you know, hooking them up. You don't have to mess with code or anything like that.
Oh, that is awesome.
It's really great, not just for musicians, but for podcasters like us too. You know, it makes distributing Trek FM shows very easy. So create your own anthem. You also mentioned a store, create your own store. The commerce feature is a fantastic, quick and easy way to sell your items online and to take orders and to process credit cards. It takes all the complexity out of that. Create your own website. whether it's a full-blown, huge website for a giant company or just a personal website for your blog and the things you want to share with the world, pull in your Instagram photos, whatever you want to do, you can do that there. So in the end, as they say, at Squarespace, you can create your own space. No matter what that space is, it's very simple to do. And watch the video and you'll see how different people are using Squarespace.
Absolutely.
It will inspire you. And Shar, if people would like to try Squarespace, I think they'll be surprised at how inexpensive it is. What is the pricing like for Squarespace?
It's $8 a month for the standard package. And that's pretty darn cheap, especially if you use our code for 10% off, which is Trek6. But if you're looking for a little more, if you want to go unlimited, you can get that for $16 a month. And that's an amazing value. But then for the business, if you want to launch a store, that's $24 a month. And that's still not bad for, tell you what, it's worth the price because the trouble it takes to code a store, as we've talked about before, you know what, you're getting a good value for that money. So they're all very, very well priced. It's a good value no matter what you choose.
Oh, not only that, but for a store, think about the fact that you would have to pay fees for credit card process. I mean, you still pay a small fee per order to Stripe, of course, because that's how credit cards work. But if you had to integrate an external service into your website to do that, you know, that service might have an additional fee, just service fee separate from the orders themselves. And so that's something where you're not having to put out money. So $24 for the business is really the cheapest way you're going to find to run just an absolutely beautiful online store. And $16 for unlimited. Remember, it's hosting and it's CMS. It's a fantastic deal. But the best way to find out how great Squarespace is to try it for yourself. And you can do that free for 14 days. No credit card required. You just go put in your name and your email address. They'll set up a trial site for you. You have access to all the features for 14 days. And then when you decide to sign up, you can use our offer code TREK6. And as a Trek FM listener, you can save 10% off your lifetime purchase on new accounts. So just go try it. Take our word for it. You're going to love it. Go to squarespace.com and use offer code TREK6. And you'll be supporting our sponsor and helping us bring this programming to you every week. Holodeck malfunctions were a common story device on The Next Generation, and on Deep Space Nine, they were a little bit shy about going into that territory. But when the right story idea comes up, you just can't resist. And that brought us the fourth season episode, Our Man Bashir, a very cool romp in the world of James Bond. And today we're going to talk about that episode, and to help us do that, we have back with us, and it hasn't been long this time, Mr. Michael Fisher. Michael, welcome back.
Always happy to be back promptly, Chris, and I'll tell you, I've got a lot of kick for a 45 dom.
I think you're back so quickly because you heard a page from Cetacean Ops, right?
That's entirely true. I did enjoy that you carried forward the continuity of the last episode I was on by paging me from Cetacean Ops on Twitter. Yes. No, thank you very much for having me back, and it's lovely to be here as always.
Great. And also we have with us friend of the show and Dr. Trek himself, Larry Nemechek. Larry, welcome back.
Hey, Chris. Thank you for having me back. I'm just here. I didn't work on too many snappy openings, so I did watch the episode a while ago just because it had been so long, and my wife walked in and she went, "Oh, this is a DS9," and I said, "Yes," and we both realized how long it had been since we actually watched a DS9. So.
Yeah, listeners may be surprised to hear you on the Ready Room this week because normally you're here for our TNG shows, but We wanted to have you on for a DS9.
Is there? Oh, I didn't realize there was such a big conspiracy about that.
Yeah,
okay.
You.
But no, yes. I mean, I didn't know there was a plan as opposed to the original series. I didn't realize there was a plan. But no, yeah, I didn't watch this like watching like Trials and Tribulations, which was another DS9 show that I did.
You were on set for Trials and Tribulations?
And by what you mean being there as they're shooting it?
Yes. I was trying to remember that tonight. So did I actually watch them shoot it, or did I just see a lot of the sets? I know it wasn't like prolonged time like TNT was, but I remember thinking how they had built so many sets for this show that they went so over budget on timing as well as the sets, and they were running out, they were crammed for space, and well, it's kind of funny that Dr. Noah's lair was supposed to be in the Himalayas because it was built on stilts above other things.
Oh my goodness.
On 18, so they were cramming in. Yeah, they really went over time on this.
Are you telling us that it was built at 22,000 feet?
Yes, that's what I'm telling you.
Larry, and what else was on 18? Was it all the rest of the sets they were using for this episode, or was it built over ops or something? I don't know.
No. 18 was the swing set, but since DS9 was conceived of like the other stages had, I think 4 had ops and the corridor and quarters. And the other stage, and then Promenade was on 17. Oh, and 4 had the cargo bay area. And then 17 was ops. And then they thought at first, oh, we'll have the caves, and then we'll have, you know, some Bajoran sets when they first started. And then by the time they brought the Defiant in, then the Defiant Bridge, and then the engineering, and then by the war shows, they had their mess room and transporter and corridor and all that. And half of the stage was taken up just for the Defiant sets. And so whenever they had anything big, And they would cover over the cave. They'd put plywood down over the cave because the cave was all submerged. And then they would do random. I just found a whole stash of DS9 set plans from stage 18 that some lighting guy gave me at the end of a year. But for this show, it got so bad that by the time they did Vic's lounge, they just had it. They just the last year, so they just rented another stage and had Vic's standing on some off stage that was on that same row. But no, this show had so many sets that they were just completely crammed in. I think Dr. Noah, somebody's going to shoot me because they've got the sets in an auction or something. I think Dr. Noah's set was like over the Santa Monica, the gambling, the nightclub and gambling.
Oh, okay.
Bit.
Yeah.
Bit. The club. What am I trying to say? Monte Carlo.
Okay.
Yeah, I think the whole Monte Carlo set and his room with the revolving bed and the turnaround bar and all that was built on the floor too. And then thankfully they did the whole laser thing down in the caves.
Yeah, I was going to ask about that. Yeah, that cave started to look familiar at this point in the series because DS9 had made some use of those caves for I think some they were about to reuse it for a bunch of Maquis stuff, maybe, and I don't know, that the cave stuff was very familiar.
It took you 4 years to see the familiar.
No. I almost never rewatched this episode, which is why I was so excited. I was like, oh, yeah. But yeah, that rotating bed and all. That's another thing I was going to say. These weren't simple sets. They were complex with a lot of practical elements that were – so it's easy to see why they went over time.
Yeah. And it was the mechanics of the sets and then also shooting. I mean, they were like doing angles, and it wasn't typical Star Trek DS9. Okay, we'll shoot stuff. We always do this from here, or we always do it from here. So let's come over here. It was like, oh my God, we're like shooting. It really was like shooting a mini movie.
Yeah.
If you think about it, I mean, and Rick Colby was the director, so it wasn't like he wasn't skilled, and they all didn't know him. But if it'd been any other director, they would have like either fired him or never had them back on the show again because they. But it was insane. It was like, come on, guys! It really was like shooting a mini movie with all those set changes. And
I wish this had been a movie. Actually, when I'm watching it and I'm getting towards the end of it, and I know that it's coming to an end, and I'm thinking, I wish this were a movie, like a 2-hour movie, because you just touch on Noah's diabolical plan. But it would be so much fun to actually see more about that. And
his map, his giant map needed to have way more blinkies. I mean,
oh, yeah.
It really did.
Yeah, it was really light.
It really did. And it's too bad they couldn't reuse these sets later in the series. Like, how cool would it have been if in Quarks, if he had a revolving wall where, depending on what he was going to mix for drinks, the wall just revolves around.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. He had a whole like illegal collection, and whenever Odo walked by, like he'd press a button and the wall would flip around.
That'd be awesome. No one notices that the entire wall is spinning.
Yeah.
I feel as if my whole world is spinning around me. It is. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the concept of this episode, because as I mentioned in the opening, they really didn't get into the whole Hollow Suite malfunction scenario in Deep Space Nine very often, you know, as they did on The Next Generation. Of course, The Next Generation, being on the ship like that, it gave you an opportunity to do more unusual things. But DS9, just by its nature, I think it had a few more interesting environments that they could go to without having to fall back on the Hollow Suite. But they came up with this idea, and it was a bit unique compared to the average. But as I understand it, it wasn't necessarily the easiest sell in the beginning. And Larry, what do you know about the kind of genesis of this and the development of this to finally get it set in the 60s in the James Bond scenario?
Well, I was just trying to refresh on that a little bit. No, the main things I remember about it was Bob Gillen had the story cell. This was his – Bob was the equivalent of my wife on DS9. He was like the assistant script coordinator in the offices. So he was like the glorified script typist, continuity checker, pagination, keep up with the color changes, and also do your bit for God and Country on continuity and stuff and catch errors if you could. And it was his sale, kind of like we sold Prophecy on Voyager, and except he didn't have the secret agent theme. That was Ron Moore came up with that. He had a couple of other scenarios down, but Ron had said, "Why don't we have it be? Why don't we pull in the joke of Garak being a real life spy, and he can make a comment on that and bring that in." And they didn't. I don't know. We're going to jump too much ahead of this, but the idea that we also, oh, it was the James Bond show. Well, it really wasn't intentionally trying to be James Bond. It just that was easy. Like our man Bashir is off our man Flint, the right. James Coburn. Because it was the 60s, and after James Bond became a hit, then it was kind of like Star Wars. Everything was imitating. You had everybody and their dog imitating James Bond on TV and movies, The Man from U.N.C.L.E. and all the spoofs, you know, and the president's psychiatrist. And oh, that's what our man Flint was, yeah. So, you know, but the touchstones everybody remembers. Oh, Matt Helm was another one. And then you took the Westerns and made the James Bond Western was Wild Wild West. So it really was that. That's part of the reason why they pulled back on the whole James on the secret agent Bashir holodeck that they thought they might be able to run with. But anyway, but yeah, Bob sold the story as his thing was, let's have a holodeck. I mean, the thing before you get too wrapped up in James Bond is this is the time when, as you were saying, you had a holodeck breakdown, which is funny because that was TNG's thing. And TNG launched with, we're not going to do any of the original series mistakes. They always had the transporter breakdown as a story launching. So we're never going to have the transporter breakdown. I was like, let's invent a new technology to break down to launch us at the story.
Right.
But since
this one does both.
Yeah, but DS9 was the anti-TNG show in so many ways. Not anti, but like, let's do something different. And one of the things was, you know, Ira especially was like, let's get away from the technobabble everything. And so, yeah, so they didn't lean on that too much. But the cool thing to me about this is Bob's idea was, let's have the holodeck breakdown, the holosuites breakdown, not be a breakdown. Let's have a holosuite trap adventure where it's actually the thing that saves people, which is, I think, is what's cool about the twist here.
Yeah.
And it actually – the breakdown is saves lives. It doesn't – you know, it's not its own thing.
Yeah, and with a surprisingly light amount of kind of shoehorning as far as the technobabble goes, and they was actually able to mine some comedy from it as well, where we get to see what the inside of Quark's holosuites look like, and it looks like it's held together with bubble gum and masking tape, and isn't there a spatula in there too?
Kitchen appliances.
Yeah.
Oh, and it's great. And running the hoses to the Defiant because DS9's memory capacity has been used up. I love that detail too, where it's like, The human consciousness is so vast that five crew members take up all of DS9's memory capacity. I think that's awesome.
Yeah.
One thing that I liked here and I thought was very DS9 is that Odo actually does bring up the point that storing those patterns, mm-hmm. there's not enough memory. You know, the computer says there's not enough memory, and Odo says it's going to be impossible to store all these patterns. We have to find somewhere to put it. And it was just that little bitty element of reality there, because typically in Star Trek, they wouldn't bother really explaining that. Just somehow there would be enough memory to store these patterns.
I'm sure they could have teched the tech and teched the tech.
Naturally. Oh, they could have, yeah.
Sure.
Yeah, of course.
On a TNG or a Voyager, I should say.
Right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But like, you know, Scotty is stored in a transporter buffer for 70 something years, or these things happen and it's fine. But I just like here that they do mention that in reality. I always think about when I read Lawrence Krauss's The Physics of Star Trek book when it first came out in the 90s. And he had this diagram in there about how many hard drives would be required to store all the information of one human being. Mm-hmm. And back then, you know, our hard drive capacities were like
400 megabytes.
A full size hard drive was, well, they were bigger than that, but they were like, I think they were even less than a gigabyte at that point. Yeah. So today, of course, it would come down, but he had hard drives stretching almost to the moon, stacked on top of each other just to store one person. So I like here that there is some little element of real life problems that you might face and saving five
and the distinction being made between there's a different, because obviously you beam six people at a time in a transporter, you have enough memory capacity for that, but the point being that's temporary versus you're going to have a long-term storage.
Yeah, that's what the buffer's for, right?
The buffer was for short-term storage, and the fact that they overloaded that and that he was on a ticking clock thing there, you got to get him out, you got to get him out, we've got to do something with him.
Yeah.
And then to go, well, the dumb Defiance docked over here. Why don't we use that? I mean, in the end, they went to that.
So smart. I love it when Star Trek remembers there are auxiliary vehicles with full loads of stuff here. It's like what everybody criticizes Nemesis for, like, well, transporters are down. Well, you got 24 shuttlecraft with fine transporters right here. But so it was great that DS9 remembered that the Defiant was there and used it. And I thought that was great. And the only thing was at the end of the episode where they get everybody beamed back onto the pad. And then the lights come back on, and it seems like the computer's running fine, but you just know that there's like a runabout full of like full to the doors with backup disks on its way from San Francisco, right?
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, subspace time machine kind of program.
But again, this whole thing is like Ira, like you think of, like we've said, Trials and Tribulations. Remember how untechy that whole thing was? Well, they went the ultimate untechy, which was, oh, Bajoran Orb of Time, you know. But and it wasn't quite that simple here, but it was intentionally, I mean, they did about just, you know, they got to say pattern buffer and molecular matrix or whatever a couple of times. But that and the fact that And then by bringing Rom in, and then you had Quark with him, that they didn't have to write a token scene for, you know, it's like, oh, it's all the main characters, and we've got all these sets, and now we have to write the token Quark 7-line scene to get him his pay for the week. And it's like, no, they made hay out of that with all the, and we also did it. Really, but I just love the fact that the technology malfunction, that the holodeck isn't the villain, it's the hero.
For once.
Yeah, and that was his thing. It's like, let's not have a time travel, let's not have a holodeck breakdown, let's have it be the hero and have it make sense. And that's why I thought it was cool.
The other thing related to this is that what triggers the fact they have to beam everyone off the runabout in the first place is that something is going wrong with the warp core, and there's going to be a warp core breach. And then they can't eject the core because the ejection system has been removed from the runabout. And when they start in with the warp core thing, at first you're thinking, okay, they're going to like make up some kind of thing about a warp core problem just to create an issue where they have to beam people off the ship. And so then they can trigger everything. But what I also like is that they found a way to tie that in to the broader story of DS9 by having this Cardassian terrorist group sabotage the shuttle. And so there's that little bit of Cardassian Federation Bajoran political bit going on there. And so there was actually a human, or at least a Cardassian, there's a humanoid physical act rather than it just being that mysterious technical glitch that sets the story into motion.
Completely. And as you already said, Chris, I loved even that tiny minor detail where they say the ejection system is offline, which we've heard now way too much in Star Trek. We hadn't yet heard it too much at that point, but we've heard it enough at this point where we're like, come on, just figure out a better ejection system. I mean, this is getting annoying.
Yeah.
But exactly. O'Brien comes in with that correction. No, correction has been removed. This is sabotage. Well, this instantly makes a lot more sense. And can I ask, I always found it a memorable moment in DS9 when they lost a runabout. So when the Orinoco blew up, I was like, oh, man, because they named him. You know, everyone had a name. So you remembered yeah. the missions they were on. You're like, oh, I love the Orinoco. I guess the only one that survived the whole 7 years was Rio Grande. But
that was the model painting. Oh, that was the physical model was painted Rio Grande. Right. Yeah, that's why.
That's a good reason.
Yeah, they didn't have to go repaint the model.
Right.
Oh, I love the pre-CGI days. Although CGI, I have this joke. I say that CGI was why the warp core. When they got CGI, they could finally have the warp cores work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
They could afford to show the warp core injecting on some, whatever ship they were on. So, yeah.
Right.
And also, Larry, I guess that's the reason why the Sao Paulo is renamed the Defiant, right? Mm-hmm. Because you don't want to repaint the model right. at the end of the
Give
series.
Yeah. Hull number even.
Yeah. Now, see, CGI wouldn't be that way. But back then it was like, we're not going to go paint the damn model with two more shows to do. Let's put yeah. that money into something else.
Now, let me ask you this.
Yes.
Does this explain why Diamond Select shipped the Enterprise B with Excelsior labels on it?
I knew you were going there.
Oh, they did? I didn't know.
They did. Yeah,
I would
yeah.
think so. Oh, yeah, it was referenced. Somebody, somewhere, whether they speak English or not or have their Trek stuff. Here's the reference. Okay, you're supposed to know that. That's like, it's not quite that funny, but when the Fact Files was going and we pulled reference for the B, Enterprise B bridge, only it was just supposed to be a standard view Excelsior class thing. And they did all the bridge with the red carpet that was down for the premiere, you know, the once around the system little PR yeah. thing that was the plot point
right.
of Generations. And they did it and it came out and I'm like, why did they keep the red carpet on the bridge? And they're like, well, that was in the pictures. I was like, that was for the
for the maiden voyage.
Okay, didn't you get that? Okay. Somebody had to say this. Okay, anyway.
That's awesome.
All right. Well, let's go back to the shooting for a minute, Larry.
Well, the one thing, you mentioned the sabotage, and it's a tiny little thing, but it was cool the way all the little loose ends of this, you were laughing about, like the spatula and the goofiness of the jury-rigged holosuites, that they weren't Starfleet standard issue, that they were Quark and Rom's little domain, especially Rom's. But all these little things that tied in, that the fact that the sabotage on the first, it wasn't a malfunction, it was sabotage, which was cool. And they made it, they tied it into, that was the first time that this group, like it was only mentioned one more time, this True Way bunch, because, mm-hmm. you know, events overtook
the True Way Bunch.
Yeah, the True Way Bunch.
Yeah, I like their T-shirts that they have, the True Way Bunch. Their tour of Cardassia Prime was just really kick-ass.
It was actually a cover band for Adam and the Space Hippies. Was what it was.
Herbert!
Very retro. It was an iconic kind of, or ironic, iconic kind of one. But they... But it was cool the way they brought that in and said, well, I could almost tell it was like as they were cranking these out, it was like the way Ira's mind works. I could see, I never asked him this, but I could just see them throw that out there. It's like, let's throw that out there because in a year we may come back and pick that up and run with it, or we might not, but it's out there. And they had so much stuff floating around to grab at, you know,
yeah. mm-hmm.
or whether it would work out or what they wanted to do or what they felt like having.
Mm-hmm. One other thing I was going to mention. When we are talking about the scene with Rom and Quark, this is another one of those moments in Star Trek in the 24th century setting where we have dialogue about money. There's no money in the future, but Rom says, well, my brother won't let me buy new parts when it breaks down, so I have to just
Chris,
you know, make do with what I have. And
Chris, there's no money in Earth's future. How many times do you have
know,
to say
I
that?
Know.
There's the ATM right there at Quark's bar with all the your Klingon Darsex and your Romulan Lex and or Cardassian Lex and all that.
Yeah.
Gold pressed Latinum.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, yeah.
Debit card.
Could never decide whether it was the gold or the Latinum that was the valuable part of that because that seemed to change somewhat frequently.
Yeah.
Worthless gold and liquid Latinum and gold. I always wanted a slip. I always wanted one.
One thing we know is that on Melmac, gold is worthless. Because Alf's spaceship, all the parts are coated in gold.
Mm. Oh, did the family experience a windfall as a result of that? No, no, they never moved into a bigger house, melting down Alf's spaceship.
No, he had to sell all of that in order to pay back a debt he had run up. So, right. No, they didn't get a windfall out of it.
Alf ended with him getting captured by the government, right?
It did, because they were trying to force the studio into giving them another season, and it didn't quite work. It was a gambit. Didn't pay off.
Sometimes. But you know who knows how to take a calculated risk? Julian Bashir, Meriwether, spy man. In the house. Segway.
I like how he says, yes, hi, I am Meriwether, Patrick Meriwether. And this is my wife, Anastasia, and my friend Garrick. It's like, let's don't give them names. It's just me. I'm not Bashir. Right.
Yeah.
It's my friend Paul.
So, okay, well, mentioning Garrick, I love at the beginning of this episode when Garrick walks in on Bashir as the program is running, and Mona is there, who I believe was Ira, right, Larry, who gave her the last name, loves it. Mm-hmm. Mona loves it.
I love that.
Well, you did catch the other two, the two characters at the very beginning. Falcon and Caprice are car names. 60s.
Oh,
yeah.
They
are. Yeah.
60s car names.
Oh, yeah. All that wacky DS9 bunch. Yeah. They love their,
But when Garrick walks in and he sees Bashir and he starts clapping, and it reminds me of someone walking in on Barclay on The Next Generation,
right,
when he's having one of his holodeck programs, except in this case, Bashir is actually doing something that could be considered cool.
By other people.
Yeah. But the thing is, Bashir is cooler on the station than Barclay ever was on the Enterprise. So, like, I feel like the stakes are even higher for Bashir, where he's like, listen, get out of here. I've got a good thing going. Nobody knows I'm weird. Just leave. And when Barclay had nothing to lose, Barclay's like, yeah, I'm awkward and I do this thing. You know,
Barclay's characters were all. Barclay was like using Troy and using Riker and using the real, before the corruption of the program. Bashir's characters were all. They were all falling out of their costumes on their own with, as fictitious characters. They didn't, you didn't know
right.
who Mona
right.
loves it and Colonel Kamananoff and all were, they were. True. They weren't figments of his fantasy of people he knew.
Right.
Right. Right. Right.
I'm still wondering why they gave Nana's character a male family name, because Kamananov would be a man in Russian. She should be Kamananova.
Okay, because it would ruin the joke.
Yeah, when she popped up, when she started talking, I instantly flashed back to, I think it was a Nana Visitor quote on that's. Quoted either on Memory Alpha or somewhere else, where she's like, this is one of the reasons I love doing the show, because how many other times in life do you need to have a really bad Russian accent for 9 days? It's like, it's really
as opposed to 50 years, which is what, Walter Koenig would tell you, but
true.
And now that's what Yeltsin has in his future too, right?
Yes.
The only problem is he actually is Russian, but has to pretend to have a bad Russian accent.
Yeah.
In order to play Chekhov in these movies. Mm-hmm. And this made me wonder too, and Larry, I don't know if you know this or not, but after 9 days of filming this episode, did Nana Visitor have trouble not speaking with a really bad Russian accent just everyday life?
I think she was okay. But this is actually about the time when she and Sid were well, not secretly dating to the crew, but secretly dating to the outside world before they talked about being a couple, and when she was pregnant later on and whatever. But she was still married, I think, to I can't think of his name, her first husband that she had Buster with. But so a lot of we watch them do those scenes together. It's like watching Bogey and Bacall and in their first movie or whatever. It's kind of like there's a little more sizzle there than you might get otherwise.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that was detectable. Mm-hmm.
They were having a lot of fun, but you almost think there might be just a little more going on there than fun.
It comes across, actually, on the screen a bit.
I think so, too.
Yeah, that was a treat. That was nice. The cast, some of the Next Generation cast told a joke at the convention I just came from that I have no idea if it is too blue for the Ready Room, but they mentioned that during the time that the two shows were filming simultaneously, many people on the Next Generation crew referred to Deep Space Nine as Deep Throat Nine. Hearing this,
wow.
Why? Because of the this came up in the context of a discussion that it was initiated by a visitor to the convention who asked if any of the Next Generation crew had ever become romantically involved, and they kind of masterfully deflected that and started talking about their DS9 cronies instead.
Bashed on their yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, thought I'd drop that in. Yeah.
Yeah, I don't think about that very often, but yeah, that's.
I love hearing things like that.
Well, luckily, talking about Garrick now, he was within the setting of Deep Space Nine, the real life spy. He worked for the Obsidian Order. Luckily, his code name in the Obsidian Order was not Deep Throat, but I thought that
Wide
this
Neck
show,
yeah. Wide neck,
which was meaningless among Cardassians, so it was not.
Wide neck forehead spoon. Come here.
He survived all those years because they would say, wipe it, take out wide neck. And they'd like, which one?
It's a liability, too, because he gets hit in the neck. He wouldn't have been hit in the neck if he had a human neck on this episode. That bullet.
Well, that's true. The bullet would have missed him if he had a human neck.
Yeah. Right?
It's a real liability. Sorry, Chris. What were you trying to say?
To lead his own show again.
Oh, that's right. So. But this show, I mean, you know, we think of this as a Julian Bashir show because it is our man Bashir. Mm-hmm. And we see all of our characters in this James Bond setting. But this is a really good Garrick show because we get to see a lot into Garrick's psyche, which we already have up to this point, of course, in the series. But a lot of the comments he makes to Bashir, a lot of the advice he gives Bashir, it really reinforces how Garrick sees the real world as a person.
And not only it's chilling what you see from him, right? Because he's playing this mathematical game and he's like, no, you know what? No, if we can't save all of them, this is impossible. We need to give up now. I'm leaving. Like,
we need to save ourselves. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And it reminds you to stay on your toes around that guy. Because he's likable and you can have lunch with him, right? But you got to be careful when you're hanging around Garrick.
Indeed.
Well, and it's a fun joke to play with. The fact that you're playing back and forth with fake spy, real spy, but then that turns very suddenly in the middle of what you think. Oh, it's a romp show. It's going to be hysterical, and there's a little bit of danger here, and it's but it's so creative the way they're using it as a heroic thing to save them, and not, you know, but then he does turn chilling and cold right there in the middle of all that and says, right. You know, screw you, let's get out of here, you know, and then he wings him in the neck and it's his Cardassian neck that gets him in trouble. And it takes him to a new level in respecting Bashir even. It's like in that one click, he goes from being his chatty Cathy lunch mate to, oh my God, he actually pulled out a gun and shot at me. Wow, you've come a long way. Did he say something like, you've come a long way, doctor? Or I'm
there may be hope for you yet.
There may be hope
like
for
that.
You yet, yeah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
It's a nice moment.
And then he says, who am I to question Julian Bashir, mm-hmm. secret agent?
But they let Garrick go from, you know, he chides him at first and has fun with him, then he turns deadly serious, and then he goes back to it. And it's such a great setup to let the real spy sit back and, okay, let's, mm-hmm. okay, kitty. Let's see what you do with this sucker.
Right.
And, you know.
Yeah.
Garrick is there all the time in this episode, and he does flip back and forth like that. And I love when they're tied and in the caves, and Honey Bear comes in, and Bashir uses the reverse psychology. So instead of trying to get this woman to do what you need her to do to help you escape by playing up to, oh, he doesn't respect you for your brain. He should respect you for your brain. It's the opposite. Mm-hmm. He only likes you for your brain. And
you,
Garrick says,
you think Garrick is going to roll his eyes out of his head. He's having such a
he does. He rolls his eyes.
He's going crazy.
It's so great. And he says, doctor, this is more than I ever wanted to know about your family.
Yes, I love that line.
Yes.
Yeah, and then when Honey Bear comes back and kisses Julian and gives him the key, and Garrick says, kiss the girl, get the key.
Yes.
They never taught me that in the Obsidian Order. Yeah. And then at one point he says, I think I joined the wrong intelligence
service. The wrong intelligence service. Yeah.
Yes, he did.
That's a shrewdly shot scene, too, because she comes back and you're not entirely sure what's happening below the frame. When they kiss him, my girlfriend even was like, what's going on? I'm like, yeah, it's Star Trek. They're not doing any grabbies. It's Star Trek. It's like, oh, the handcuff key. Yes, of course. Okay. All right.
Right. This episode was nominated for Outstanding Hairstyle. It was not nominated for a Grabby Award.
Right.
Aww.
Oh, I know the award show I'm starting.
And for that, Michael, you're going to be switching your persona away from Captain Two Phones back to Fats Riker.
Back to Fats Riker Beard. Grabs a lot. Yeah.
Sir Grabs a lot.
Because Mona loves it.
There you go, buddy. There you go.
Great stuff.
Oh, so Chris, you were going to get into the bit about why they didn't revisit. They built all those sets. You would think that Julian Bashir's apartment would have been like a running set, kind of like Da Vinci's lab or Dixon Hill's office, maybe. kind of.
Right. It's a good thing they didn't hire an actor away from another television show to come in and play a James Bond character for two episodes and then abandon it. Sorry, Leonardo Da Vinci. But this is such a fun episode, and I mean, I can't say that I necessarily personally wanted them to revisit this from time to time, because it's the kind of story that's fun, but if they were to redo it from time to time, you would get kind of tired of it, I think. It's like,
Captain Proton. Aww.
Truth.
What?
Truth. Got a little tired of
saying, I'm just saying. Well, Dixon Hill was like every couple of years they would do a dabble and then, you know, do a big screen.
Dixon Hill had some more mileage in it than Captain Proton, I thought. But I don't want to – Charlene is making a face that I think is telling me to – encouraging me to shut my mouth.
Oh, no. Go on.
Well, she –
no, go
no,
on.
She no is co-host of To the Journey.
I know.
Yeah, I got to defend my Voyager here. And Captain Proton was...
Proton's fine. It was that poor Fairhaven that was really sad.
Oh, let's not talk about that. I'll be right back. I gotta puke now.
Okay, Father Doctor.
My favorite tie-in for Dixon Hill was actually in First Contact when Picard goes and he brings it up. And they don't speak the line, but it comes up on the screen. The big goodbye.
Yes.
Totally. Yeah.
I love those kind of just little visual.
Seduced by a movie budget, are you? I see.
No, it's the fact that they call back to the title of a first season episode, and they don't even say the name of it, but it's right there on the screen.
Yeah. I love those little bits of fan service.
Yeah, I started to say if they'd said the name, they might have had to pay Tracy Torme, but the fact that it was just an art graphic and that you got Mike doing everything. Yeah,
this is how Larry's mind thinks. It always goes back to who has to get royalties if this line is spoken or printed on the screen.
That's what I go. Oh, right? Okay. It just, Well, speaking of royalties, that is why we didn't see any more of these.
You work in the production environment, so you know what goes on behind the scenes. And so that's why.
Okay. Well, sometimes it like gets past you, but they took pains to make this not be a James Bond show, but the who did the music? It comes across as Barry-esque with all the screaming trumpets and everything at times.
Yeah,
you know. So anyway, so MGM UA United Artists screamed a little bit about it being too Bondian, so they never went back to it.
I think it was Jay Chataway did the music, and yeah, it grabbed me too. At least that's what Memory Alpha says.
It was Jay Chataway?
Was it? Okay.
Oh, yeah. And this came out, this aired the same week that GoldenEye premiered.
Yes.
Right.
I remember that.
So it was kind of like, it was like the Robin Hood and the Q Show year, you know? It was like, okay. Except Robin Hood's public domain and this kind of wasn't. And they were like, look, we named it Our Man Bashir, Our Man Flint. They were like defending. But there was like that one little bit in in A Simple Investigation, where it's kind of a joke. He's just sitting in the back of a taxi very nondescriptly, and right. Odo walks in, and it's O'Brien playing Falcon again, and they're like, oh God, but that's the only other time you got the secret agent bit again, because they had been, and they had done that with Sherlock Holmes. They had gotten a letter from the Holmes, from the Arthur Conan Doyle estate had sent them a letter, and they thought that meant, get away from this. And then a couple of years later, somebody from the group was like, why don't you ever do any more Sherlock Holmes data shows? And they're like, because you all wrote us and said not to. And they're like, no, we didn't say that. And they're like, oh, okay. So that's why you suddenly had it pop up like fifth or sixth season again. But yeah, they definitely got the word to cool it here with
Julian Bashir.
It's fun to think about that from the perspective of all of normal people today who put out content on the web, and some of them rip stuff from other stuff and put up plagiarized stuff on YouTube, and some people share files and whatever. And if you do that as an individual, and you get busted, then that's really serious. Like, that's like a big deal. But it makes me think, like, and Larry, I'm sure you offer some interesting perspective on this. Like, what happens if you're Paramount Pictures and you do that? And you're like, here's this James Bond thing. And then MGM's like, you stop doing that. And you're like, okay, but we're also Paramount Pictures. So are we going to get into a lawsuit fight about this? And you guys, like, this is your only valuable property, MGM. So what is it? I don't know. Like, they obviously acceded to their demands, but it didn't, What are they going to do? The episode was already out there.
This was syndicated, so it wasn't like Paramount Studios Pictures. It was Paramount TV. And it's like when the attorneys run things, and it's like, even if we just settle this, it's like, do you really want to lose some production budget money going and paying them $500,000 to just, okay, fine, we'll make it go away. We're all good for now. And whenever we sell this show, we will get like 0.1% of the profit off this one episode. I mean, do you really want to keep messing with that? Or because sometimes they would be a little self-limiting. And then you have the times when some writer or some artist in it either inadvertently or vertently does something, and the powers that be don't even know it's there. A little bit like on the pocketbook side when that author did Ishmael, and it was using Mark Leonard and all the Trek coincidences of casting that were in Here Come the Brides. And so they had Spock losing his memory and going back in time, and he wakes up in Seattle at this lumber mill in the 1880s Seattle, and he's feeling very fatherly figure toward the guy who runs the mill, and it's like Mark Leonard's character on Here Come the Brides and all the other characters. And it's out, and somebody at Screen Gem goes, do you really mean to like rip off our old show here this much? And nobody at Pocket had any clue that's what was going on, and so they had to like recall the novel. But the fan author was like, oh, I thought it was a cool idea. And no one anywhere along the way got it that's what was going on. The fans that read it knew it, but nobody in an office anywhere back, it was before Paula Block and before all the savvy fan people and John Vansitters and people were doing novels. That was like in the 80s. So anyway, so on a studio level, you could see something like that slipping out and going. So usually the attorneys are real conservative. But that was back then, and your point about now where everything is so, loosey-goosey back and forth, because of the web and everything, it might be different. It's like, oh, yes, we're so honored for you to pick them and rip us off and get us more sales. because all the blog pieces about it are going to send you over to buy us on Amazon now. So, shut up and let it happen,
Right.
Well, if you want to read that book, Michael, it's all the copies of it. They're in New Mexico. They're buried with the Atari 2600 ET game cartridges.
With the spent nuclear waste? Okay.
Yes.
Right. On the back porch near Funk and Wagnalls near Roswell, New Mexico. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah.
That was a horrible combination.
But it's kind of odd because, Sherlock Holmes, James Bond, just like Star Trek itself, it's one of those properties that is going to be played off of and parodied a lot in popular culture. And it wasn't really to me like they weren't ripping off James Bond here. It was inspired by James Bond. So I'm kind of surprised that MGM would get that upset about something that, if anything, it just makes people remember the James Bond movies more and go see that James Bond movie that just came out in the theater.
Yeah, honestly, I thought if anything, it was kind of a cross promotion at the time. I thought that's what was really going on. Like, hey, we'll scratch your back if you scratch ours. So
yeah,
apparently not, huh?
Well, that's the way, I mean, that was like in the 90s when the Paramount attorneys made all the fan sites. Not the guys at StarTrek.com. They were like going, what are you, an idiot?
Right.
But the attorneys jumped in and said, shut down all these fan sites. And then within five, mm-hmm. six, 7 years, mm-hmm. it became a, no, you mention them, they mention you, and it's all one big happy fleet, and, you know, and we right. all buy each other's stuff. Yeah. But the yeah. way the internet opened, you know, the online world opened that can of worms up, because it used to, I mean, there was a time on Communicator when Patrick was first doing Professor Xavier in the X-Men movies, and somebody pitched the idea of having a Patrick Stewart, like half and half, like half Picard, half Professor X, and it was like a radical thing, and we didn't do that, but, and they were going to do a compare Picard and Professor X, like, you know, fighting and intelligence and charisma and get the girls, and I mean, you know, whatever. And it was like a funny, it was when people were starting to get a sense of humor and open things up and think out of the box and stuff. And I remember thinking, oh, they're not going to let us do this. And things had evolved where we actually could do that. And that was like a real watershed, because the year before we could talk about Trekkies, but we couldn't talk about Free Enterprise because it wasn't licensed. You know, it wasn't a Paramount property, oh, right. so we couldn't do that. Mm. And within a year or two, things had loosened up to where it is the way it is now today, where you can go, jinx, you know, you don't want to be excluded from the conversation. You want to be in the conversation and sell your stuff. But so, yeah, it's amazing how that kind of thing now, how it would affect the thing. But I was just looking at some old notes I wrote on this. This is like the last time they kept going with Bashir and his holodeck playing, but after this they started to pair him up with O'Brien, and how this almost went from a it's like they started developing the thing that they played us later on about you're only role-playing hopeless, you know, like the Alamo and the Battle of Britain and those kinds of things. And they would always go to something that was so huge production-wise you could never show it again. It was almost like, we're going to punish you for going over budget with our 19 sets here. You guys will never do that again. It's like, we're never going to show one of your holodeck things again.
Hearing about the Bashir and O'Brien holodeck excursions did become a bit like hearing how Morn talks all the time. Or about how, yeah, all the stuff that you've never seen. And it was cute in that way, but yeah, I wanted to see the two of them in a fighter plane from World War II duking it out. I thought that would have been great, but of course, yeah, reality didn't allow for that.
or CDS9 was great about they do that, or they'd say, oh yeah, I'm going to go down to the docking bays because the Andorian ship just came in with a Tholian ambassador, and you know, you're like, okay, well, at least they're still alive, you know, kind of a thing.
We want to see that fight scene. Come on.
I'll take your blood to Andorra.
Yeah, that's where the Andorian fight scene took place.
Yeah, we missed that.
Yes. Important stuff.
And of course, that was Jeffrey Combs playing the Andorian ambassador.
He is everywhere.
Of course.
Have to be.
the Greek Andorian ambassador that we don't see. Yeah. Himself, kid. Yeah.
Well, as for the story itself, what thoughts do you all have on the story? Because we didn't really talk about Dr. Hippocrates Nero, as I call him, because he's going to shoot lasers into the mantle of the planet. And so he's Nero.
That's a clever joke there.
Yeah.
No. So Noah here and his plan. And of course, I thought that Avery Brooks, he plays both crazy madman scientist and crazy madman pianist both very, very well.
Only Avery Brooks can do that.
Oh, God, yes. Chris, when you were lamenting that this episode didn't get turned into a film before, I was thinking that Avery Brooks really delivered enough energy in his performance for a feature-length thing, but it was condensed into two, like, five-minute scenes. And it reminded me of Avery Brooks being interviewed by William Shatner in Shatner's documentary.
Yes, exactly.
Very, very frenetic energy about his performance in this one.
And who else could pull this off after you tell someone how you've changed your mind, you're rethinking your approach to life, and you go in this whole thing that Bashir went on, and then the response from Avery Brooks is, ha!
Well, that was the Cisco hoop. Yeah, the weird little. Yeah. I remember the first few episodes, the very first few episodes of DS9. He would do that. Oh, Jake, I love you so much. And you're going like, yeah. What was that?
Whoa, buddy.
Or the.
Yeah.
This sand is hot.
Oh yeah.
Ow. Ow.
It is. Yeah. Do you know what this means?
Ow.
It wasn't even an ow. That was like at least relatable. He would just do that like you just like, you know, you just lop the neck off of a cuckoo bird or something. It would be that, you know, like or something. I mean, it wouldn't be that. It's like, where did
it's
that
impossible
go?
To reproduce.
But he had tons of fun with those cigars. He was having way too much fun with those.
Dude, everybody was fun with cigars in this episode.
Worf.
Worf was especially
having fun. Yeah, Worf got him with the old cigar trick.
Awesome. I love that.
I actually really didn't like that aspect of this episode. I understand they were referring more to the period and making it real to that time, but I was remembering how just cigar smoking was a big trend in the 90s at this time, and I just thought, oh god, of all things for Star Trek to trend upon, why this? Ew.
Why casual cigar smoking? Gross.
That one kind of torqued me off.
But it was Bond in the 60s and the villain.
I know.
Only
I
the
know.
Bad guys had cigars. Now, come on. You mean there was your subtext.
I know. I had to put my thoughts aside, but it was tough.
Well, now, here you're talking about the fact this was really a Garrick episode. Think back on this, too. This is the last show where Kenneth Marshall's Eddington is a good guy.
Oh, yeah.
That's right.
And if you watch it in hindsight, the whole time he's talking about saving them and pattern buffering and how much he knows about the station's capacity. He's got, you know, he's got his manual override. You know, it's him and Odo in there, he and Odo. And he's like, you know, Eddington, 9572, you know. And speaking, did you catch when Dr. Noah – and, you know, the whole James Bond, no, we weren't doing James Bond, but then Dr. No was kind of hard to scream and, you know, argue with. But did you notice when Dr. No was talking about his masterful evil lasers plan and the fact that they had 74 lasers around the world?
Yep, noticed it.
Little 74 inverted. Yes.
That's nice. Yeah. Love it when they sneak that in there.
Just had to get that on there. Had to get that out. Yeah.
We were on the other podcast that I do, and it was episode 47, and I was doing the lead in, and I was like, "This is episode 47 of the Pocket Now Weekly podcast," and that's an opening for a Star Trek joke, and nobody else on the air with me is going to get it, so we'll just move on. But my friends in the ready room probably know what I'm talking about.
I think somebody should just do an episode 47 of whatever show they're doing, and just say, "And this is episode 47 of Larry's Pod," and you know. Need we say more? Good night, everybody. And then
you're welcome.
So, Larry, tell us more about what would Larry's Pod be about.
Oh, I was momentarily excited that this was a real thing.
I don't know, but I would always keep the doors closed. I don't know. What would Larry's Pod be about? Larry's Pod would be take the most obscure piece of canon gap and fill it.
Okay.
I don't know.
Sounds good.
I don't want to drag off. I should say I found a box. We're cleaning out a ton of stuff, and I started finding some old files from. I found my old Interstats, and I found the very first letter I ever wrote to Interstat. It was like, oh, I could have said this like yesterday. It was really talking about recasting characters and gap filling canon when it doesn't exist and there's no hope of it ever being filled again. And anyway, it was just really strange. And all my like old well committee letters to people when I was answering questions for them. And it was like, oh damn, this is like a carbon copy off a typewriter, but it's like the same damn thing. Nothing's changed. But anyway, I'm sorry. So, but yeah, Chris, we can have a contest. What would Larry's Pod be? I don't know.
In-depth episodes about, like, you know, preventing icing on your outer hatches and, you know, maintaining enough rations and keeping the window clean so the pod works right. That's what I would like from Larry's Pod.
Oh, okay. Okay. It's like, so what did the janitor's uniforms look like?
Yeah.
You know, something, I don't know.
Yeah. Reminds me of Planetfall. Anybody play Planetfall?
No.
Commodore 64 and the Apple II. The old Infocom game. Thank you. Yes, Chris.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, oh, I had that. God. Yeah.
I was moved to tears at my computer as a six-year-old. Play Planet.
I had all the Infocom games. Yeah.
Infocom was a great
game. I even had the... Now, talk about getting off subject here real quick, since you brought up Infocom. I actually had the boxed version of the Infocom Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, which came with peril-sensitive sunglasses.
Oh, they were so good at putting stuff in the boxes with the games. But yeah, there's a lot of room in the box when you all you got is a 5 1/4-inch floppy in there. You got to fill it with other stuff.
That's right.
Oh, that's great.
All right. Well, we're about to hit an hour, so let's just wrap up with final thoughts on our man Bashir. Shar, what are your final thoughts on the episode?
My final thoughts are that on paper, this sounds like it could be a really horrible episode. Because you have a transporter malfunction and a holodeck malfunction, and then there's a bunch of role play, meaning it's probably going to be a lighthearted romp episode, and it could fail so bad with those elements. But we've discussed every reason why that was not the case, and it's a pretty fun adventure. Now, I'll confess, I am not the biggest Bond fan. I don't really go crazy over the spy movies, but even so, I got a lot of the references and still enjoyed it. I could see that the actors were enjoying this, too. They were having a lot of fun. The costumes are fantastic. There's great attention to detail in the sets, as there always is. And you know what? It's a pretty decent hour of entertainment. It's, even though there is stuff of continuity in here, I don't know if it's the most important Deep Space Nine episode you'll ever see, but it is still fun to watch. So for that, I think I'll give it 7 cigars.
Oh,
did I take yours?
You took my rating implement.
I'm sorry.
But it's okay. Mine were going to be poison cigars, so I'm glad that you decided to make different ones.
You're fine then. You're fine.
Sometimes a cigar is just a cigar.
It's just a cigar. That's
right, Dr. Freud.
Counselor Troy has a good point when she says that.
So did Bill Clinton.
I knew it was coming.
Sorry, couldn't help it. Too easy?
Too wonderful, too excellent. Charlene made some really excellent points, and I will add to it only by saying that two things. One is my girlfriend, who watched this alongside me, said of this episode, and in particular of Avery Brooks's performance in this episode, she likes this better than most other DS9 episodes she's seen. She's not a huge DS9 fan. I am a massive one. But even I, as a massive fan, have to hold episodes to a pretty high standard when they blow up a runabout. And as we said before, I'm really kind of passionate about my runabouts. And I don't like runabouts getting blown up in episodes that are otherwise crap. And thankfully, this one was not. It was a really, really fun hour of TV watching some of my favorite characters just have a ball and watching the actors behind them really have a ball and seeing that bleed through on the screen. So really, I had a ball, and I was glad to rewatch this one for this podcast. And I would give it 8 rounds of Baccarat.
Excellent, because Baccarat, like geology, is your life, right?
That's correct. Yeah, that's exactly right. Exactly right.
Larry, do you have anything to add?
I just was looking. Here's a couple of like little extra things. Because of the overrun of the shoot, Marcy Brickhouse, I love that name, who was Mona Loves It, the way they had it structured, because of the actors' union rules and everything. When they ran over, they actually had to hire her for 2 extra days, even though it was the scenes where she's laying on the floor with the knife in her back. I guess they couldn't use a double, you know, or whatever down there. Laura Richards, who was a set dresser, everything they used in all those sets, all the 60s stuff, was all in Paramount storage. They didn't rent anything. They just went and dug out from their stuff. Bob Blackman was thrilled with all the costumes they got to do, especially in the Monte Carlo scene, but he was pissed that so little of it got on screen, which was kind of standard. And Sid's tuxedos all came off the shelf, but all of Garrick's suits had to have the neck widened, which meant they had to have it for the stunt guys and for the doubles, so they had to make like 3 Cardassian neck tuxes for anything he wore had to be tripled and all that.
Wow.
So Anyway, it was just wacky. It's like when on DS9, I love DS9 too because of the huge cast, and I always look out for the underdog, and it's getting less and less this way, but DS9 used to always be the underdog show. You know, it was like the middle child, like I used to say, and it's getting more respect, but I still go back when I think of all my favorite DS9s, with maybe the exception of just off the top of my head, and I think, oh, Little Green Men and Armand Bashir, and you know, I think of the finale and the pilot, but a lot of them are like these. They're always like the atypical shows. It's like, oh no, come on, you gotta have it. So, Pale Moonlight and some of the war shows kind of fill in. Oh, and Bada Bing Bada Bang is kind of funky. But it's like DS9 had this. So for the show that was supposed to be the darker, grittier, you know, we're not gonna put carpet on the walls show and have a counselor in the bridge. DS9 was the one that was the maybe for being that way was the show that had the most ease in changing gears and doing these. You know, lighthearted or mixing the light mm-hmm. and the routine. Like I said, this wasn't like a ha 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 show, and Trials and Tribulations is another one of those whack because the drama made sense and you went, oh good, the holodeck didn't just break down to be a breakdown. It actually saved the day. And then you had the humor of the jury rigged holodeck with the holosuites with the Starfleet and all that stuff. It all made sense and it all played out. And you know, all the little bits and pieces seemed to make sense and it wasn't too contrived. And you could see them scrambling around going, oh, hell, what do we do with this situation? You know, saving the pattern. So anyway, I've always just loved this. The fact that I got to see some of the sets and a little bit of the filming was very cool. And I always give them props for trying something big like this, even if they got shut down or they felt like they got shut down. So I would give this a – I would give Armand Bashir a 009 out of 0010.
Nice.
License to Kill. Just don't slap me with a cease and desist trademark infringement.
Watch for your letter from MGM, Larry. Yeah. It's coming.
Do they still have their own stationery? Do they still have... Do they still exist long enough to have papered stationery? Still around.
I think that's all I've got left.
All right. Well, yeah, I've always loved this episode as well. It's just a lot of fun. We did not spend the entire show talking about Nana Visitor, as I said we would. But whenever they put her in these period costumes, whether it's this, whether it's when she's in Far Beyond the Stars, whatever it is, she just looks fantastic. Hair styling, dresses, mm-hmm. whatever.
Have you ever seen her at a convention, Chris?
No, I have not. I've seen her, just her, but not at a convention, no.
You've just hung out with her, but you haven't seen her at a convention.
That's right. No, either dinner or
I've
nothing.
Seen her. I've seen her as just like casual interview, being herself, you know, not being a Bajoran or not being another character in a show or something yet.
She's such a delight at conventions.
One of the first things she did after the show went down was she played, there was a touring, it wasn't New York, but there was a touring company of Chicago and she played Roxy. Hart in that right after it was one of the first things she did after they got out of the series. So anyway, there's good pictures of her.
Yeah.
One other quickie little thing. This actual script they wind up writing for this. Oh, I just realized Bob autographed my script. That's funny. There were no cut scenes or no like deleted unfilmed scenes, which is one of the reasons why they went. There's like four or five lines here that were either filmed and not used or they didn't even use it. And it's just a little bit in the lair up in Dr. Noah's deal. But I mean, they filmed like the entire, the whole sucker and didn't like leave anything out. So,
wow.
Were those lines that weren't used, were those Noah's actual response to Bashir before he made the noise?
It's actually the first lines in, yeah. What are you, cuckoo? Who's a cuckoo? I know a Starfleet captain that's just like that. It's basically, I think it was like the writers thought they had to cover. It's when they first wake up in the lair and he first makes his appearance necessary. Now I can't find it. Here it is. I think it's they're trying to cover how they got from, were they in Santa Monica? Santa Monica, I did it again. Were they in Monte Carlo? Yeah. I think it's how they got from Monte Carlo to the top of the Himalayas just like that.
Oh, yes. They were in Monte Carlo. Yeah. That's right. And then they're at
and
the top,
it, yeah, it opens up and he says, he's walked in and Noah says, I must apologize for the unorthodox travel arrangements, but you see, I value my privacy. And he says, I completely understand. He says, may I offer you brandy, cigars? And Kira says, cigar. An unusual request for a woman. And she says, I'm an unusual woman. And then it goes into, I understand your field is geology, Mr. Meriwether. It's almost like the writers were trying to, in the logic of the moment, cover the fact that they went from Santa Monica Carlo to the yeah. It's like, who's worrying about that at this point? You're like, just, you know.
I'm glad that was cut out. Yeah, because you don't need an explanation, right, in this situation. They already have, they've hopped from Hong Kong to Monte Carlo. Yeah. Well, now they're
right
on the slope of Mount Everest. Who cares?
I'm glad they were cut too, but I'm happy that I got to hear Larry doing Avery Brooks doing Dr. Noah.
Which yes, was yes because
I'm watching the audience forum dials, and they're all just like, you know, the lines are just dropping away now.
No, I'll tell you guys, there's something going on Trek FM podcasts, because on last week's Orb, John Tenuto does his Sisko imitation. And today, Larry's doing his Sisko imitation.
Awesome.
I know what podcast I'm listening
Who's
to tonight
next?
After we record.
There's something in the DS9 waterworks, and Rom had nothing to do with it. Yeah.
Sure. Why don't you do your Sisko for us real quick? Perfect.
God, that was awful. You I can't do impressions. Like listen to the latest To the Journey, where we do a commentary of Blood Fever. And we kind of got onto the Arnold Schwarzenegger part of commentary where he just describes everything as it's happening. And so we had Tristan do his Arnold Schwarzenegger commentary impersonation many times over. But I did a John Madden, which was okay, but nothing quite like that.
You had him doing Schwarzenegger doing commentary on the Blood Fever fight?
Well, on the episode, yes.
On the episode? Okay. I was just, okay.
That sounds like a recipe for success. That sounds awesome. Yeah.
It was
and
a
the Vulcan is doing this and that and some other things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He has a phaser now. Yeah. Yeah. It was fantastic. I really wish he would have done the entire episode like that. I suggested it. He declined.
Well, remember we tried to get Matthew to do the entire Ready Room when we did Fairhaven and Spiritful
in
his Irish accent.
His Irish brogue. Oh, God.
Yeah. It would have been lovely.
Instead,
circle back around and have him do it as what's his name with the Bring Lloydy on Up the Long Ladder.
The next time
you can make Melinda Murdoch mad all over again or something or whatever. Yeah. Okay.
The next time that we four are on the podcast, can we sing the Ella Moraine refrain in parts?
Oh. Oh, well, why don't we just next time, because people have been asking us to do this on the Ready Room. Let's just do Move Along Home.
Oh, God, please invite me for Move Along Home, because I have watched that episode 40 times in my life. I know it front to back.
You know, in its defense, that was like maybe the most butchered on at the 11th hour show ever in Star Trek.
I did not know that. I did not.
Really?
They got, like, they had just done the pilot, and that was like the second or third show, and the pilot went so over by the time they posted it that Michael came in and they, like, cut down three. Like, no, you get one set. That damn corridor with the diamond doors.
With the triangle.
On that.
Yeah.
They cut characters, they cut sets, they cut everything, and that's why it wound up being such a, you know, such a cluster.
Oh, wow.
My 12-year-old didn't know the difference. I had a great time. Alan Moraine, count to four. Great time.
And they'd already spent like the money on that game board. So it was like, let's all peer at the game board in as many different angles as we can.
Six.
Oh, God.
I'm pretty sure if we go and we interview some of Michael's classmates from middle school, they'll tell us about how he was actually doing that hopscotch game.
Absolutely.
In the
I'm just standing. I'm standing in the hallway, just telling people, move along home.
Oh man. Okay. Well, we should wrap this up. So, bottom line for me, yes, I love this episode. It's fun, and it also gives us those great moments where we get to see into Garrick's mind in a serious setting. And I'm just going to wrap this up. I'm going to give this 10 go-go dancers.
Nice.
Awesome. So.
All right. So before we go, Michael, tell everyone where they can find you around the internets.
People, if they want to find me on the internet, can find me at Captain Two Phones on Twitter. It's Captain the number two phones, discussing mobile technology and sometimes horrifying specials on Discovery, like the one I watched tonight of the man walking across the Grand Canyon on a tightrope, which was incredible. But I used to tweet at Fats Riker Beard, and you can follow me there too if you want to hear the deafening sounds of bearded silence.
Right. And also, follow that account so you'll be one of the first to know when the Grabby Awards launch.
That's right.
Totally.
That's right. Stay tuned for updates on the Grabby Awards.
I can't wait for this.
The Grabby Awards. Yeah.
Awesome.
All right. Yeah. Larry, what do you have going on and where can people find you?
Well, LarryNimichek.com and TreklandBlog.com, and I'm very behind, and we're about to hit SoonerCon in Oklahoma City, and then Comic-Con in San Diego, and Vegas Trek in Vegas. And yay! And the Con of Wrath is still got its crowdfunding. We're still working on that. And I still have my secret book that I can't say anything about yet. We can't say anything about it anywhere, although it'll be announced within the next month. But if you're a nonfiction fan and you're missing having some of that gap filled, we're going to do some more of that because the world is changing and there's more Trek nonfiction out there. Cool. And this will be one of them. And I have to now say, go to Star Trek Continues and do the Facebook page and all that stuff. That we've had like between the episode and the shorts, which I was not in as McCoy, but they were there. The three shorts and the episode on Vimeo and YouTube have now gotten about 250,000 views.
Awesome.
Excellent.
And we're about to go back and do that. We shot a little promotional piece the other day at Vasquez Rocks for it, so that's coming out. So that's Star Trek Continues in the Facebook and all that stuff. And
cool.
Trekland on Facebook and Larry Nemechek on Twitter and yada yada.
And Larry, give us your favorite McCoy line from the first episode of Star Trek Continues in your bones, as of course.
My favorite line? Oh, well, Jim, it's damn peculiar.
That is
perfect. I didn't have a Dr. Nada, and I didn't have a he's dead Jim, so oh well, that's what we humans do. I mean, you know, there's out of context they kind of lose a little bit, but yeah, fine.
You didn't say, damn it, Jim, I'm a doctor, not a Star Trek historian.
Yeah Yeah, we're going to write that into the that's the sidebar DVD special bonus feature blooper scene that will be pre-written for the next one now that it's a big thing. Yeah.
Perfect. All right. Well, thanks a lot for joining us today, guys.
Thanks.
Thanks for having me, Chris.
Well, Chris, I thought that was a fun discussion of our man Bashir with Larry and Michael. It was fun to have those two together for this episode. Come on. When is it not fun to have Larry talk about his experience on the set, the things he gets to witness? When is that not fun?
Oh, it's always fun. And having Michael on was great, too, because Michael always picks up on some of the more unusual elements of the story, being an actor. And the two of them together was great. One thing about this episode that I did not get to mention in my final thought there was that I really wish that Honey Bear had stayed on the show as a regular cast member for the remainder of Deep Space Nine.
You wanted Honey Bear actually on Deep Space Nine?
Right, yeah.
A scientist?
Yes, that's what I wanted.
Oh, okay. That could have been interesting. How do you think she would have gotten on with Jadzia?
Yeah, I don't know. I'm thinking, who would Bashir be after then? He's got Jadzia and Honey Bear. Tough call. Maybe Garrick will have to figure that out for us.
Of course, he did kiss Honey Bear.
That's true. And then as she walked away, she just looked at Garrick like, don't you wish you were getting a kiss?
So maybe Garrick would be going after Honey Bear while Julian still pines for Jadzia.
Could be.
Maybe.
All right. Well, let's tell everyone where to find us if they want to share their thoughts on Our Man Bashir or anything that we talked about in news today. You can go to trek.fm/contact. There's a form there. Just choose to send to a show and choose the ready room, and that'll come to us by email. If you'd like to send a voicemail, you can easily do that now from any page on the site. Just look over to the right side of the page. You'll see a tab that says Send Voicemail. If you click that, a box will pop up. You can record a message with your camera mic and upload it to us as an MP3 file right from the webpage. You can also talk to us and other listeners on our forums at trek.fm/forums. There's a section for the Ready Room. There's one for DS9 as well as every other series. And also, you can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trekfm. And if you're the kind of person that likes to tweet, like we are, you'll find us on Twitter under username TrekFM. Now, Char, what if people want to find you personally?
Well, as you said, we like Twitter, and you can find me there for sure. My handle is Oh the Profanity, and you can also find me all over the place on TrekFM, of course, primarily these days on To the Journey, where I co-host with Tristan and Lori, and we talk about all things Star Trek Voyager.
To the Journey. You didn't give me an opening there.
To the Journey. Yes, yeah, kind of awkward with only one other person, huh? And how about you, Chris? Where can they find you?
Oh, if you want to find me, you can find me on Twitter. My username is C. Brian Jones. That's the letter C and Brian with a Y. You can find me pretty much everywhere in social media under that username. You can also find me on your iPhone or iPad in Star Trek Rivals, which I'm kind of addicted to right now. So hit me up on Twitter if you want my friend code.
Yes, me too.
Yeah, definitely. So hit me up on Twitter if you want my friend code, and I'll give that to you there. And if you want to read some of my writing on other things besides Star Trek, you know, look at photos, all kinds of other stuff I do, I have my own website back up and running now. It's at cbrianjones.com, and you can check things out over there as well. And as for the network, you can also find me on two other shows every week with Matthew Rushing. We do Literary Treks, where we talk Star Trek books and comics, interview authors, and sometimes watch the holographic Doctor riding on a horse, which is really bizarre. And you can also find me on The Orb, where we talk about Deep Space Nine only every week. So if you enjoyed our DS9 show today, definitely go over and try out The Orb. Well, Char, before we let everyone go, we also want to remind you to support our sponsors who help us bring this programming to you every week. First, we want to invite you to create your own space over at Squarespace. Go check out that video that we talked about today in the news segment. Find out how you can use Squarespace to create your own website, your personal blog, your store, share your music, share your artwork. And as a TrekFM listener, you can save 10% by using our offer code TREK6. But before you do that, try it free for 14 days. No credit card required. Just go to squarespace.com and then use offer code TREK6. And also, we really want to encourage you to go over to trekfan.org and check out this very unique new fan club. But it's not just a fan club like you're used to. It's a challenge. You're going to get together with other fans to solve puzzles and complete real-life mission objectives. You'll be learning new things and you'll win great prizes. Go to trekfan.org, solve that first challenge that's on the webpage there. That'll get you to more information and find out about this very unique opportunity for Star Trek fans. Well, Char, it's time for me to head off. I'm going to go over and see if I can help Honey Bear with a little research.
Of course. I think it is time we stick a bad Russian accent in it, because this Ready Room is done.
Oh, and Laura wanted to use shag carpet on the sets, but they wouldn't let her because it would have bogged down the camera dollies. How about that?